From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Elizabeth Neufer. She covers the United Nations and foreign affairs for the Boston Globe. She's recently been in Iraq and Iran, which borders Iraq, and is one of the countries President Bush considers part of the axis of evil. We'll talk about the war, where Iran fits in, and what role the United Nations may play in the future of Iraq. Then we'll talk about how this war has affected the relevance of the UN Security Council with Philip Gurevich, a staff writer for The New Yorker, who recently profiled Kofi Annan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Elizabeth Neufer, covers the United Nations and foreign affairs for the Boston Globe. She's covered several wars, including the Gulf War, the war against terrorism in Afghanistan, and the conflict in Bosnia. She recently reported from Iraq, Kuwait, and Jordan, and spent 3 weeks during February and March in Iran. She wrote about the aftermath of war and war crimes tribunals in her book, The Key to My Neighbor's House, Seeking Justice in Bosnia and Rwanda. Earlier today, I spoke with Neufer about Iraq, Iran, and the United Nations. You were recently in Baghdad. What's it like for you now to watch it being bombed?
It's a very sad day for me on any number of levels. I mean, just a few days ago at the United Nations, there was still the last gasp of hope for peace. Today, the war has started. As I turn on the television set, I'm trying to guess, you know, are the bombs falling on places I know, on people I met? I worry not only about the Iraqis I befriended, but of course, like every American, about our own troops that and the dangers they face.
You were also recently in Iran, and I'd like to talk with you about Iran. They have a nuclear program in progress. They say it's for nuclear power. The United States, the Bush administration, thinks they're on their way to nuclear weapons. Does the Iranian government fear that it's next after Iraq that we'll be attacking Iran once we've ousted Saddam Hussein?
You know, I didn't hear that, Terry. I went to Tehran expecting to hear that. But I think that there was this kind of attitude in Iran that Iraq would keep us busy for some time. And Iran was very focused on its own internal political struggles, the fight between reformists and conservatives for control. And I think people were paying much closer attention to that than, frankly, they were to the threat of imminent war on its borders between the United States and Iraq.
What does the Iranian government see as being in its best interest during this war with Iraq? I know, for instance, that they're concerned about refugees crossing the border from Iraq into Iran. So let's start there. What's the Iranian plan to deal with those refugees?
Well, they really don't want refugees this time around. They were swamped during the last Gulf War and swamped with refugees from Afghanistan. And many of them have stayed and stayed and stayed. I visited one camp where people had, you know, transformed what looked like shanties on the outside into palaces inside with television sets and carpets and furniture, and they had been there, in fact, since before the last Gulf War, more than 12 years. Some people had been in those refugee areas for 15 years. And the Iranian government does not want a repeat of that. So what they are doing, or their plans are, to try and, quote, help the Iraqi people inside Iraq. It was very vague as to what exactly they meant by that. But they held open the promise only that Iraqis really fleeing for their lives would be allowed to cross the border into Iran, and then only to temporary encampments set up along the border, right directly next to the border.
Iran is on the Bush administration's axis of evil, along with North Korea and Iraq. Iran and the United States have had a pretty bad relationship since the Iranian Revolution. But, of course, Iran and Iraq have been longtime enemies. And during much of the 80s, they fought a terrible war. It was the Iranians who were, as well as the Kurds, gassed by Saddam Hussein's military. Did you get a sense of what popular opinion is now in Iran, if the public is taking sides between the U.S., and Iraq?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, because I went to the anniversary of the revolution. It's a huge sort of big march that happens every year, and people come and listen to speeches, and they're, you know, anti-American flags and anti-American, you know, banners. And yet the topic of the speech by Mohammad Khatami as he addressed the crowds was the war and Iraq. And talking to people afterwards, I mean, to be really honest, every time they kind of led people in an anti-American chant, it was kind of half-hearted. And, you know, it's sort of like, okay, let's go back to sort of business at hand, which is thinking about the war. And there is absolutely no love lost for Saddam Hussein. I didn't meet an Iranian who wanted to see Saddam stay in power. In fact, many spoke quite openly about how relieved they were that he would hopefully be removed from power. But underlying that is a sense of, you know, uncertainty about what it will mean to have American troops taking a position next door.
And patrolling the border between Iran and Iraq.
And patrolling the border and what that means. I do think that there, as I said, there was no sense of panic among anyone I spoke to that Iran would be next, even though they are on the axis of evil. I think that there's some sense that North Korea, in fact, might emerge as the next big problem along the axis. And for the moment, certainly in the areas in which the reformers have control, I think they're trying very hard to sort of dissuade the Bush administration in some ways that, in fact, they deserve being on the axis. And in other ways, obviously, the announcement about nuclear power plays right into the administration's fears.
Elizabeth Neufer is my guest. She covers foreign affairs and the UN for the Boston Globe. She was recently in Iran and Iraq. The Saddam Hussein government is a Sunni Muslim government. Saddam Hussein and the people who he is close to are all Sunni Muslims. But the south of Iraq particularly is largely Shiite Muslims. Iran is predominantly comprised of Shiite Muslims. What kind of feeling of connectedness did you get from Shiite Muslims in Iran toward the Shiites in southern Iraq?
There isn't a strong bond, Terry. I mean, they are similar religions and there's an affiliation. But it was striking when you go into the Iraqi neighborhood of Tehran. They have tried to recreate a sort of miniature Baghdad. And the fact that, you know, Iran was also Shiite and they're Shiite wasn't what provided comfort. It was the fact that, you know, there's now a pastry store where you can get good Iraqi baklava, something you can't get in Tehran normally. So there isn't a strong bond. There is a sense of religious affiliation. That said and done, what one of the most intriguing things to watch as this war unfolds will be the role played by one of the lead Iraqi opposition groups that is based in Tehran, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution, often referred to by its initials, SIRI. I interviewed the head of SIRI and many of the sort of different people who are working for it. Their claim is that they have troops in Iran ready to cross the border to help wage war against Saddam. And they also say that they have many people in Iraq that have joined with them, that are loyal to them, that are awaiting their word to sort of lead the battle. Many of their members are defectors from the Iraqi military. And the Iraqi military defectors I talked to were just waiting for the word to cross back in and fight against Saddam. But what's interesting, Terry, is they said they would not fight under an American flag, that, in fact, they would be waging their own separate war. And they felt no allegiance to the American troops. So if, indeed, those forces exist and if, indeed, they get mobilized, it will be very intriguing to see how that plays out.
What are the possible scenarios there if, in fact, former members of Saddam Hussein's military who are Shiites who oppose Saddam Hussein, if they cross over from Iran into Iraq, what are some of the possible scenarios after Saddam Hussein is overthrown, if they don't see themselves as identifying with America's mission and with American troops?
Well, that is the key question. They did cross over in 1991 when the first uprisings began in Basra. And I think it was back then that there was some pronouncement made that there was a hope that, you know, Iraq would become, you know, a much more Islamic state like Iran. Since then, they've become, or this particular opposition group has toned down that message. They are taking part in all the discussions with other opposition groups. They're part of the sort of, you know, top five members of the opposition that have been meeting. They say that they want a federal Iraq. They want a democratic Iraq. But I think one question that, you know, will remain open will be how well will they collaborate with Americans, if indeed they're there, if indeed they have the numbers and the support they say they do in the South. And secondly, you know, will over time, will there be pressure from them to, in fact, turn parts of Iraq into a more Islamic society than it is currently?
If there were at any point a Shiite rebellion within Iraq that led to a Shiite government, do you think it would be a militant Islamic fundamentalist government?
I don't, based on the Iraqis that I met, who obviously were Shiites. I mean, they see themselves as having a slightly different religion, but I don't think they see themselves as, having an Islamic state in quite the same way that Iran does. Now, whether that's true for the Iraqi exiles who are Shiites in Iran who hope to return home is a different question. I mean, again, many of them have been exiles for 15 years. They were granted safe haven by Iran. They feel they owe it a certain allegiance. And I was struck one night when a member of the Iraqi opposition was sort of showing me around the Iraqi neighborhood of Tehran. He turned to me and said, "Oh, you will fix your scarf. Your hair is showing." And I turned to him and I said, "You know, you will not be able to do this in the new democratic Iraq because women will not necessarily be required to wear headscarves. It will be a matter of choice or religious preference." And he was completely taken aback. So there are elements of this I suspect they haven't thought through entirely clearly.
Assuming that the U.S. military does succeed in ousting Saddam Hussein, does succeed in regime change in the very near future, what are some of the things you'll be looking for in post-Saddam Iraq, some of the problems that you're watching out for?
Well, I'm looking for any number of problems, Terry. The first thing I'm going to be looking for is indeed the question I raised. Will people be fighting alongside the Americans if they begin to fight, or will they, in a sense, start their own internal civil war? I think civil war and sort of vengeance killings are going to be the first big problem. The second big problem is one that, in fact, was faced in the late 1940s in Germany. We often hear about denazification. In Iraq, the question is going to be de-Bathification, I suppose. How does one root out the Ba'ath Party and really find those people who played a role in keeping Saddam Hussein's regime propped up versus from those who sort of got swept up in it and had no choice? I think the other critical thing we all must really watch is I think it's vitally important to bear in mind that the Iraqis do not want to be ruled by Americans and do not want to be ruled by American troops. Our presence there has to be minimal. It has to be short. It has to be swift. We have to let Iraqi opposition groups take a lead. And then the fourth question is going to be, how can these Iraqi opposition groups who have spent so many years quarreling, despite their recent show of solidarity, will they really be able to make a new government? Will they just splinter and fall apart? Unlike Afghanistan, we have yet to see Ahmad Karzai emerge, a charismatic figure with no tainted past who can rally people behind him. I haven't seen that yet in Iraq. I haven't seen that yet among the opposition. And I'm worried that without a figure like that, it will be very difficult to in a sense, rally the nation.
My guest is Elizabeth Neufer, foreign affairs and UN correspondent for the Boston Globe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Elizabeth Neufer. She covers foreign affairs and the United Nations for the Boston Globe. She was recently in Iran and Iraq. When you were in Baghdad and talking to people there, did you get a sense that they were awaiting the U.S. military with optimistic anticipation, thinking that the military would be the source of the Iraqis' liberation?
No.
Or did you feel a sense of dread that this was the beginning of occupation?
No, absolutely occupation, not liberation. And every time I hear the Bush administration use the word liberation, I must admit I wince because that is not the sense. That is not how they're perceived on the ground in Baghdad, even by the Iraqis, as I said, who I got to know, who were very critical of the regime. This is a very deeply proud nation that is, you know, looks to its past civilization, that looks to its day, you know, the fact that it invented handwriting, that sees itself as a, you know, historical player, and does not want to be ruled by anyone else. And it's very important to remember that. They're also immensely skeptical of the U.S. government, very welcoming to Americans, but very skeptical of the American government because of the role the American government played in maintaining the sanctions against Iraq. The sanctions have devastated families and ruined society and undermined the, you know, economic infrastructure. And it's kind of hard for them to feel that the same country that played a role in ensuring there were massive sanctions against them will now swiftly turn around and, quote, liberate them. I think we have an uphill battle in terms of public relations to convince people that, in fact, we are acting in their interest.
So would you say that from what you were able to assess, a lot of the people in Iraq hate Saddam Hussein, they want to see him overthrown, but they don't want the U.S. to do it, and they don't want the U.S. to have a say in their government or to occupy their country after Saddam Hussein?
Right. They certainly do not want the United States to occupy their country. And they really don't want the United States to rule their country. I think that, you know, people will be in some quarters, people will be ecstatic to see Saddam removed from power. But I think they're deeply worried that those American troops are there to stay. They want to rule their own country. They're deeply proud. They're proud in the same way that Americans are. And you can imagine how we would react if a foreign country came here and said they were going to liberate us. This is not something that they're particularly embracing with open arms. It's very different than, say, it was in Afghanistan.
When you were in Baghdad, had the United States already begun leafleting Iraq, you know, asking the military to not resist, and I think also, you know, addressing the Iraqi people about how they will be liberated by the U.S.? And if so, I'm wondering what the reaction to these leaflets and to other American messages directed to the Iraqi people was.
Yeah, they had begun leafleting in the South, Terry. And again, it's always hard to know because in the interviews one did publicly in Iraq, people had to choose their words very carefully. But mm-hmm. I did ask one Shiite leader from the South what the reaction to those leaflets had been. He said, oh, you know, we just tore them up. Was that the case? I don't know. Clearly, there will be a lot of people who will be convinced or swayed by radio broadcasts or leafleting. But I really think that the day of judgment is going to come by how American troops behave once they arrive. I have the confidence, having watched American troops in Bosnia and elsewhere, that in fact, it's one of the things they excel at is arriving and getting to work and rebuilding and creating goodwill very quickly in that sort of quick post-war period. The fact that we have an army that is racially and ethnically and religiously diverse is an immensely powerful symbol to a country that's as fissured and divided as a place like Iraq. But, you know, I would have to emphasize that everything I heard from the Iraqis is that they were deeply suspicious of the American motives and really didn't want the United States to stay in their country for very long.
There are civilian brigades within Iraq who are armed and who I'm sure Saddam Hussein expects and wants to resist the U.S. military. You watch them, you reported on some of these civilian brigades. Is it your impression that they would be willing to fight the U.S. military?
I think some of them will be willing to fight, Terry. The question is how effective they will be. These were brigades of largely older men and women. You know, these aren't 19 and 20-year-olds. These were 30 and 40-year-olds. That had been trained and carried, you know, were great, looked very impressive on the parade ground with their AKs and, you know, snappy step and good salute. But the question remains as to just how good they're going to be against American forces. I think that the key thing that we're all wondering about is will there be a guerrilla-style war that's waged against American forces as opposed to, I think, any Iraqi knows that they would lose in a conventional battlefield situation against American troops. That's very hard to predict. Will people just simply surrender and put their weapons down, or will they want to fight? You know, one key difference from the last war, which I also covered, was our ground troops didn't go in until after a very long air campaign. And a lot of the soldiers that surrendered in the early stages of that campaign had been right along the border, had been, you know, subjected to just day after day of relentless bombing. And I'm convinced part of the reason they surrendered was they, you know, just the psychological pressure of that bombing. And plus, Saddam had put his, you know, his least well-paid and least valuable troops up at the front line. So now we have a different set of situations. You know, we may not be advancing with American soldiers into Iraq after months of bombing when people are really worn down by it. So perhaps there will be more resistance with this particular moment in time because people won't be so weary of war or weary of bombing.
Most news outlets, including your newspaper, the Boston Globe, have ordered their reporters out of Baghdad. Has that been controversial at your paper?
I don't know if it's been controversial at the paper. I think the paper acted very sensibly in many ways. I think it's controversial for the reporters in that our job is to bear witness. And I know that every reporter in Baghdad was wrestling with their own conscience about torn between the desire to remain and bear witness to what was going to happen and their loyalties to their company, their loyalties to their family, their loyalties to their friends, and their own concern about whether or not they would get killed in the process. This is an immensely difficult decision for news organizations and an immensely difficult question for reporters. I don't feel that those who chose to leave are any less courageous than those who chose to stay behind.
Elizabeth Newfer covers foreign affairs and the United Nations for the Boston Globe. We'll talk with her about the UN in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with journalist Elizabeth Newfer of the Boston Globe. Then we discuss how the war is affecting the relevance of the UN Security Council with Philip Gurevich, staff writer for The New Yorker. He recently profiled Kofi Annan. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Elizabeth Newfer. She covers the United Nations and foreign affairs for the Boston Globe. This year, she's reported from Iraq and Iran, as well as the UN. Elizabeth, let's talk about the United Nations. You were there yesterday. You've been there today. What would you say is the mood at the UN now?
Unbelievably somber, Terry. You know, it was only the end of last week that there was still this sense that there was a diplomatic window of opportunity, that a compromise could be found, that there would be a way to, you know, create some more space to see if Iraqi compliance with UN resolutions to disarm was, in fact, as genuine as everyone felt it had to be. Suddenly, that all kind of vanished in a puff of smoke. And there's bitterness. There's a lot of postmortems going on. I think there's a sense among the Security Council members that they must unite and move forward. Everyone recognizes that. But, you know, this is a body that was largely created at American instigation, the United Nations, with the ideal of preserving peace, guaranteeing peace, and authorizing military force only as a last resort. And it was unable to do either. It was unable to reach a consensus to do either. And I think there's a deep sense of disappointment and particular bitterness at the Americans for, in a sense, undermining an institution that they played a role in creating.
Are there any proposals that you've heard for how to unite the UN now?
I think the immediate proposal at hand that will unite the Security Council is one that goes right to the heart of what everyone's immediate concern is right now, and that is humanitarian aid. The Iraqis enter this war, Terry, after 12 years of crippling UN economic sanctions. And those sanctions, as you know, spurred enormous starvation in their early years, created extraordinarily high rates of malnutrition. And in order to offset this, the UN allowed Iraq to sell some of its oil on the open market and to put that money into a UN-supervised fund that could then be used to buy food and other humanitarian supplies. This became, since 1996, perhaps one of the most efficient and one of the most remarkable food distribution systems in the world. 60% of the Iraqi people depend entirely on the food that comes to them from the Iraqi government through the UN Oil for Food program. There's great concern about, will famine occur if this program absolutely vanishes? So on the table now before the UN Security Council, or soon to be on the table before them, will be a draft resolution that would allow Kofi Annan to basically take the place of the Iraqi government and tap into this fund and use that money right away to get food to Iraqi people and to be able to sort of pick up this existing distribution system that's in Iraq and enable food to flow swiftly to the Iraqis.
There were documents that the Bush administration gave to the UN in support of regime change in Iraq, documents that turned out to be forged. These were documents asserting that the West African country of Niger had sold tons of uranium to Iraq. Now, the CIA and Colin Powell acknowledged that these documents were forged, but that came 6 days after weapons inspector Mohammed El-Baradei said that his team had found that these documents were faked. What has the fallout of this been so far at the Security Council?
I think the fallout among diplomats has been rather huge. I think the gap between the administration's case that it brought to the Security Council about why Iraq was continuing to arm and trying to subvert the UN weapons inspections versus what the UN weapons inspectors themselves reported was just immense. We saw on, I think, three or four different occasions, Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix actually very politely contradict the administration's findings. We had Colin Powell go before the Security Council to point to show satellite photographs of a particular site and then that site a month later and to say, you know, this was clear evidence that the Iraqis were trying to hide this, this, and this. And when Blix went before the council later, he politely disagreed with the Secretary of State. And in fact, a lot of the stuff they brought was open to interpretation. And indeed, Mr. El-Baradei and Mr. Blix sometimes interpreted things differently than the administration did. And in the case of the documentation, as Mr. El-Baradei found, it was forged. So some of the stuff that the administration was relying on for its case proved to be weak documentation indeed.
How much has that damaged the credibility of the Bush administration within the Security Council?
I think it left people with the uncomfortable sense that the Bush administration was sort of pushing its case too quickly and too aggressively. It left people skeptical. why, if they felt so certain and so convinced that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, why were they not making a clear and convincing case to the diplomats? Where was the intelligence? Where is the beef, so to speak? I think it's left people a little wary of some of the claims that have come forward. And again, I think these are the kinds of things that people will be evaluating. I mean, this is another interesting thing, Terry, I just want to draw to your attention is Dr. Blix, in his sort of farewell remarks to some of the reporters 2 days ago, you know, made it clear that he'll be very interested to see what American troops do find in terms of weapons of mass destruction. And I think there are a number of diplomats who are also going to be very interested to see, you know, well, where are the things that we basically went to war for?
Well, Elizabeth Neufer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, Terry, thank you.
Elizabeth Neufer covers the UN and foreign affairs for the Boston Globe. Coming up, how the UN's relevance has been affected by the pursuit of this war. We talk with Philip Gurevich, a staff writer for The New Yorker. This is Fresh Air. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said this morning that it was possible Iraq could have been disarmed peacefully had diplomacy gone on longer. How does starting this war without the support of the Security Council affect the strength and authority of the UN? My guest Philip Gurevich recently wrote about the Security Council and Kofi Annan in The New Yorker. He's a staff writer for the magazine. He's also the author of a book about the genocide in Rwanda. I asked him first what events he thinks have defined the UN in the post-Cold War era.
Post-Cold War era story of the United Nations is that with the collapse of the Soviet Empire and therefore with the sort of collapse of the paralyzing rivalry on the Security Council, suddenly the UN went through a brief period in the late 80s and early 90s of a sense of can-do euphoria and a real, almost hubristic at times, notion that it could do anything, that it could finally fulfill its mission. And suddenly you saw the negotiation through the UN of the ceasefire in the Iran-Iraq war and the demobilization there. The UN oversaw the withdrawal of Soviet forces from Afghanistan. It started to oversee elections and peace processes in Namibia, Cambodia, El Salvador, Mozambique. These were huge, long, ongoing, often wars that had a strong element of being Cold War proxy wars. Suddenly these wars were being resolved. The UN was in there with these gigantic missions, things that they'd never done before. They were hiring in a hurry. They were deploying all over. And then you had the invasion of Kuwait by Saddam Hussein in 1990, and the Security Council agreed, wait, this is exactly the sort of thing that the United Nations was designed to deal with. The United Nations, to the extent that it's charged with this phrase, international peace and security, that's exactly what it means, between nations, international. You do not allow one sovereign country to have its sovereignty violated by another. So the idea was, we've got to get together and repel this act of naked aggression. And that was the Gulf War. And when, although nobody really relished the idea of seeing a massive armada of fighting equipment go forth under a UN flag, there was a feeling at the UN that here we finally are able to do the sort of thing that we were meant to do. This is a war under a vast international coalition. It's a kind of, it's not really a war, it's a police action.
So how did the story change after the Gulf War in 91?
The story changed after the Gulf War in 1991 when suddenly, instead of dealing with the aggression of one nation against another, you started to see the UN getting entangled in Bosnia, in Rwanda, and this was all particularly after Somalia. In Somalia, the killing of UN peacekeepers first, Pakistani peacekeepers, and then subsequently the famous Black Hawk Down killing of the 18 American Rangers, led to a complete shift in the way that all of this was done. And mostly it led to a shift because the Clinton administration simply lost all of its stomach for peacekeeping and even for any kind of military action abroad. And so the chilling effect of Somalia on the ambitions of the United States to use the UN as a tool for peacekeeping in the post-Cold War world, and the ambitions of the UN itself to serve as kind of the world's intermediary force and the peacemakers, you cannot overstate how in one day in Somalia, with the deaths of those 18 Americans, an entire shift in the world order took place. And then you saw Bosnia, and then you saw Rwanda, where in fact the UN had a presence and was unable, not only unable to muster the will to stop the slaughter, but in many cases seemed like almost a tacitly complicit force in the slaughter when it stood by and watched in Srebrenica during the massacre, in Srebrenica, the largest massacre since the Holocaust in Europe, where UN peacekeepers basically handed over the town to this Bosnian Serb forces who then killed more than 7,000 people, mostly men and boys. In Rwanda, you had 800,000 people killed in 100 days while a UN peacekeeping force was systematically reduced and withdrawn. These were enormously damaging to the United Nations system. The reason for them, of course, was to some extent that there wasn't will on the Security Council, and to a large extent that lack of will was America's lack of will, the Clinton administration's. But it also reflected a kind of larger functional incapacity of the UN as a bureaucracy and as an international bureaucracy, a bureaucracy that works by committee, that works by consensus, that doesn't have the efficiency and alacrity of the decision-making of a single government, and also lacks, crucially, Terry, the accountability. One thing that one saw in the mid-90s was when America was serious, it went and did things on its own, and so did other great powers and other major countries. But when you wanted to avoid dealing with a problem, but you wanted to make a gesture of concern, you went to the UN, you went to the Security Council, you deployed a few peacekeepers who were unarmed and incapable of dealing with the situation, and the disgrace then seemed to fall to the UN. It was a way of ducking your own accountability, and nobody at the UN has ever been punished for failing to enforce a peace agreement.
Do you think that this explains the Bush administration's willingness to ignore the majority of the Security Council members and go forward with the war on Iraq?
Well, it's really important to bear in mind that American unilateralism is hardly some sort of Bush invention. One doesn't even have to approve of it to say this. It's Clinton acted without UN approval three times during his administration. And this was pointed out to me, for instance, when I was reporting on the UN this fall by Richard Holbrooke, his own former UN ambassador. When we went into bombing Bosnia, we didn't get a Security Council approval. When we went into bombing Baghdad specifically, on several occasions under Clinton, we didn't. And most importantly, when the NATO action against Kosovo took place. And this is really the key precedent, I think, that we should bear in mind as we look at what's happening in Iraq right now. The Clinton administration went to the Security Council quietly, sniffed around. It didn't put forward a proposal. It basically went and asked the permanent members, what do you think? And Russia made very clear that it would absolutely veto any resolution to take military action against its Slavic brother, Serbia. At which point, instead of putting forward a proposal and having a big debate, the Clinton administration and its NATO allies said, fine, thank you. We know that we're not going to get the UN behind us. We'll go do this on our own. When they completed the military action, 77 days of intensive bombing, they immediately turned. And during that period, throughout the war in Kosovo, the military phase, you also had a strong diplomatic phase where America and its European allies were negotiating both with the UN and with one another about how they were going to deal with the aftermath. As soon as it was over, a movement was made at the Security Council to say, look, we want the United Nations to run the civil administration of this while NATO continues to preside over the military, police, and security apparatus. The Security Council passed a resolution authorizing a UN administration in Kosovo. In doing so, they essentially retroactively approved the military action.
How do you think the outcome of the debate on Iraq and the willingness of France to have cast a resolution, if it actually came to a vote, how do you think that's changed France's position as a world power, or France's position on the Security Council?
It's very difficult to say exactly how that's going to work over time. I think that France has probably injured itself in making a grand gesture. The word from Paris and the reports from Paris are saying that they are actually very grateful not to have been forced to cast a veto. They were not, and at the very last few days, it was really a question: would the Bush administration sort of force France's hand to cast the veto and be stuck with that stain on its record, or not? Now, you might wonder, why is it a stain to stand up for what you believe in? It's not, except that France took a position which was at least as non-negotiable as the United States' position. If it now appears clear that America went to the Security Council and said, basically, we're going to war in Iraq and we would like you to sign on. Here's the dotted line. Sign or make yourselves irrelevant. The French said, we are not negotiating either. We think that there is no situation in which we could justify anything that allowed for the use of force. This is in direct contradiction of the resolutions that already passed, the French. So this is very wounding. It puts France in a kind of corner. And it makes France suddenly unable to claim that it was working for unity, that it was working for international consensus. It obviously took a divisive position. It also infuriated the Bush administration. It infuriated Tony Blair, who was clearly working much more fiercely than the administration to find a compromise position, and who expressed his frustration, I think, quite unambiguously and in not very diplomatic language in the House of Commons the other day. And I think those wounds, the diplomatic wounds, the damage that France did to the European Union, an organization in which America is not only not a member but really has no particularly grand influence, when Chirac exploded and scolded the Eastern European states who were supporting America and called them ill-behaved, badly brought up little countries that had missed an opportunity to shut up. This is an extraordinary explosion and deeply destructive. That damage is going to take France a good long time to get over.
In 1998, Kofi Annan said, vis-a-vis Saddam Hussein, he said, the UN is not in the business of taking out any president. Is what the U.S. was asking for, which is not just enforcing the weapons inspections, but regime change, is that considered outside of the job description of the United Nations?
Yes, the United Nations is a fundamentally conservative organization. And I think this is an important thing to keep in mind because one thinks of the UN as standing for all these progressive things, you know, greater world order, a little bit of compromise, shared sovereignty, you know, international justice, peace, all these fundamentally progressive causes. But it's actually in its bones a very deeply conservative organization, and conservative in the sense it is there to protect sovereignty. And the idea is you don't change, you don't meddle in the internal affairs of other states. This has always been an argument for non-intervention even in the face of genocide. And in this case, I think the feeling is, look, Iraq is a member of the United Nations. The United Nations' job is to seek diplomatic solutions to tensions and problems. Its job is not to advocate regime change. That is nobody's policy anywhere. And, of course, when it was first being spoken of in 1998 and so on under the Clinton administration, regime change was the idea that the United States would support Iraqi oppositionists in changing their own regime. It's taken this new form of direct assassination more recently.
Kofi Annan met with Saddam Hussein in 1998 when Saddam Hussein started to block weapons inspectors from sites that they wanted to inspect. What kind of agreement did they reach, Saddam Hussein and Kofi Annan?
At that point, the inspections regime had been going on 7 years. It had a lot of success at the beginning. It had finally come to a standstill with the sort of games that one associates with Saddam Hussein. He was prohibiting the inspectors from visiting a number of massive facilities which he claimed were presidential sites. This was not a category that had any meaning in the agreements that he had agreed to, but he suddenly said, you can't visit them, they're presidential sites. And there was this standoff, and the Clinton administration was threatening to bomb, and the French and the Russians, just as now, were saying, oh, let's let him go. And Kofi Annan went on a mission, and he played it up very big. He called it a sacred mission of diplomatic duty in the name of world peace, and he met with Saddam Hussein, and he basically made a deal where he said, look, you won't get bombed, and we won't push quite as hard with the inspections. And Saddam Hussein put on a lot of restraints and allowed the inspections to continue somewhat more delicately. And Kofi Annan came back and said, this is a man I can do business with, a line that's haunted him ever since, because, of course, Saddam Hussein had really given him the business. He had completely deceived him and pretty soon started breaking all the agreements. So for a moment, it looked like Kofi Annan had averted a war, and he was celebrated for that for about a month or two until the whole thing fell apart. Saddam Hussein then kicked out the inspectors. That's the famous 4 years ago that one heard about last fall. The Clinton administration bombed a little bit for 4 days, and that was when basically Iraq was sort of put on ice as an issue and left for the next guys, and that turned out to be President George Bush, whom we have now.
My guest is Philip Gurevich, a staff writer for The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Philip Gurevich, a staff writer for The New Yorker. He recently wrote about Kofi Annan and the UN Security Council. You wrote a book about the genocide in Rwanda. There are some people who have traditionally thought of themselves as anti-war, who find themselves supporting the war in Iraq in part because of what happened in Rwanda or Kosovo. Has that reporting on Rwanda shaped your opinion on America's war in Iraq now?
Frankly, I've always been ambivalent about the concept of humanitarian intervention. I support the desire behind it, which is to say, in the case of Rwanda, for instance, people always said, if the world had only taken action, all of these lives could have been saved. And I believe that's correct, that the world could have acted in a way that would have saved many, many lives. I also would always say, it's probably erroneous wishful thinking to assume that were the so-called international community or the great powers to act, they would act in a way that was both attractive, successful, and what one might have wanted. Because historically, it's the same people who get upset by interventions who also call for them. In other words, if you say, oh, let's act, you have to be able to accept the fact that they may not act the way you'll want them to. That ugly things can happen, that the aftermaths will not go the way you like, and that not all interventions are successful humanitarian interventions, and that, of course, what you are calling for is war. In the case of Iraq, I think a very strong humanitarian intervention argument could have been made. The problem is that it would have been better to have made it in the immediate aftermath of the Gulf War, when Saddam Hussein was actively involved in slaughtering his own people and committing great atrocities against the Shia and the Kurd populations. And when that was particularly striking because he had agreed to an armistice and a truce. So a case could have been made then. The difficulty at the moment for a humanitarian intervention argument is, of course, that there is no direct provocation. Saddam Hussein is one of the appalling tyrants of the past century. And he's a savage to his own people, but he's not in the course of a campaign against any particular population right now actively that we are going into halt. So, and the other thing is, the argument has not been made. This war is not really being billed as a humanitarian intervention. It's being billed as a regime decapitation, as they're using the phrase now, an attempt to basically take out a particular leader. And then as a liberation, it's also being billed as a war of disarmament. I feel that there are too many war aims to be able to be comfortable about it. But I think that the humanitarian argument for this war is actually strong. There's no question that Saddam Hussein is an enemy of all the things that not only the United States, but the United Nations and presumably the EU should stand for. And I think the problem is that the way that the diplomacy has been handled, the rhetoric that has been coming from Washington, the Bush administration does not inspire confidence in its capacity to manage the post-war scenarios it's talking about. To me, the relevant example here is Afghanistan. Looking at Afghanistan and the way that America has failed to follow through in the reconstruction and the post-war phase of Afghanistan, has obstructed a nationwide peacekeeping force, etc., leaves one to worry. Will we stay the course? Will we do what would be necessary to prevent Iraq from becoming a much bigger problem over time?
Philip Gurevich, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Philip Gurevich is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Earlier this month, he profiled Kofi Annan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Bondonato, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue to examine the history and politics behind the war in Iraq. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.